Blog Talk Radio.
Fasten your seatbelts. The foremost authority on 9/11, the best-selling author of Methodical Illusion, and a researcher extraordinaire, Rebecca Roth is about to step up to the microphone and launch into Reality Check, where the light will shine brightly upon the truth.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rebecca Roth Show. Here we are, high atop Mount Roth in the Swiss Alps. Hopefully, our internet.
Give away our location.
Hopefully, the internet connection holds up, and we'll be able to get through the entire hour. One never knows, does one?
One doesn't.
Rebecca, how the heck are you?
Well, I'm happy to say I'm alive, and that always makes me happy after that brush with death I had a few months back. I just got a message from someone on Facebook that was wanting to know the launch date of that third book, and they had to apologize that I'd been so sick that it really set me back about 6 or 7 weeks or so. And all I could do was spin the novel part of the story. And most of the investigation work, most of the research had been done. Just now had to figure out the delivery, you know.
Well, that really was my next question. What have you been doing besides writing with both hands?
Writing with both hands and both feet. I'm really trying to catch up. I have the artwork figured out for the cover. We're working on a book box. So if we can do a boxed set of all three books, so if you want to give it away for Christmas, and that's all in the pot, in the works, in the stew pot. And the book is coming along, and really a lot, as soon as I have a launch date, and that's going to be from when I get in touch with the editor and get her committed to my schedule and figure out all of that, then I'll have a real good idea of a launch date. And I'll probably, again, in our little online store, do a pre-order sale. So you can order it, and as soon as I get a box of them in, out they go, signed. And those books in our store are all autographed. So, and you know what? I almost didn't do that, and I'm so glad that I did. I love the connectedness with the reader. And so, you know, people read it and they email me and we chat or become friends on Facebook. And I really am glad that I ended up being talked into doing that.
You know, you were telling me the other day, and I think you mentioned this on the air on one of the shows we did about a fifth grader who's been communicating with you and then doing a book report or something like that. Tell the audience about that, because it's just, it always fascinates me when somebody in the, you know, fourth or fifth grade with a brain, you know, really wants to exploit it.
You know, it's really cool because now kids, our youngest kids, you know, in their late 20s or mid 20s, early 30s, they were pretty young when this whole thing happened, and a lot of them really just don't know. But when I got this email, I wish I would have known. I'd have pulled it up and actually read it. It's really cute. Maybe I'll post it out on Facebook in that group that we have. I like to put things there because if I go into Facebook, usually I just want to put stuff in there where most of those people are people who have read or really are into following the YouTubes that we've done and stuff. So try to get everybody on board and brought up to speed. So when book three comes out, they'll be all ready for it, and they won't know that what we're all talking about there. They're going to not be in the dark. So I try to get everybody brought up to speed. But yeah, it was really cute. He introduced himself as a fifth grader, and I don't know if his parents read the book. I don't know if he found it on YouTube. Honestly, I don't know the background, but that he was doing a report or had done a book report, and it really got his teacher's attention. And so then I have a high school senior also who is in my group on Facebook, who is just finishing up Methodical Illusion. I think I got a message from him that he had to stay up all night long. And I think maybe he's looking at his deadline to get the book report done. But he was very excited. The book was moving pretty quickly. And, you know, Methodical Illusion, you know, was written for the sole purpose of waking up people who are still maybe in cognitive dissonance or in denial, or like my hairdresser said, she just didn't want to know that our that we were lied to, or that our government would allow another government. Or,
well, that's really true, not only of methodical illusion, but methodical deception, you know, has that same information included in it, and really has the same purpose. And from what you have told me about this third book, it really, in a combined set, is really moving the whole message forward. And I think that's one of the things we kind of want to talk today about that.
Yeah.
You know, somebody had questioned about the Saudis. And if you look at Drudge, you know, the Saudis claim that if they get blamed for 9/11, they're going to start dumping assets.
Yeah, well, in a sense, they got blamed for 9/11. You'll remember that 15 of the 19 supposed hijackers, which we all know now, were not on the planes at all. And I think that's the shift. And that was the shift for me personally. I had been brainwashed for about 8 years, and I just assumed that those planes somehow, I knew that people that weren't pilots, I couldn't get in there and fly a plane in precision like that. And I talked to many pilots that, one, the 757 that supposedly hit the Pentagon was flown way beyond the aircraft's capacity. The aircraft would have literally shredded apart. And I have heard from people from not just the military, airline pilots, but also people that worked at Boeing or still do, that reassured me, yes, you're right, that plane would have ripped apart. And these aircraft are not designed to pull the kind of G-forces that would have been happening on a 270-degree corkscrew turn into the Pentagon. It was impossible that that aircraft would have hit the first floor, only because it was taller than that. The tail section and the whole body of the aircraft was taller, would have hit the second floor, not just the first floor. And you can kind of see when you see those early pictures of the Pentagon that it was hit by something much smaller than a 757. And so I got some of those details. Now, some of those details are going to come out in the Hood book. So
I was just going to say, don't go any farther.
But yeah, people are asking me a lot about the redacted 28 pages. Now, the redacted 28 pages, I have discovered through various sources, will probably never be unredacted and made public until they're changed. Like a lot of things we found in a lot of the flight paths, a lot of what the FAA said the planes did, a lot of the radar and all of those things we've already seen. Well, the 28 pages, this is information that supposedly came out in the investigation that we keep hearing people talk about, that they indicate involvement of the Saudi government somehow. Well, now I've gone into this extremely deeply. And one of the things I've found is that in the redacted 28 pages, that the footnotes in there, guess who they point to? The Israeli Mossad. Uh-oh. So guess what? You're never going to get those unless they rewrite them. So you see a lot of this. But I think what's happening now, I have to honestly tell you that I think at least 10 autographed books I have personally autographed and signed and sent to Israel. My people who I have a couple of really big fans that email me from there, and they're 100% on board with what I found in those first two books. And so I know those of you that have been out there calling me an anti-Semite, put a sock in it, because you just can't do that. The truth is not anti-Semitism. It is what it is. And so when you are holding your breath for the 28 pages, you better exhale and take another deep breath in, because it probably isn't going to happen unless it comes out. Now, when the Saudi government just is on Drudge Report, on Zero Hedge, on all of these alternative media, which are also controlled by the same people who control the mainstream media. And when you see them all talking about this, they're all misdirecting you, because it's not going to happen unless they rewrite them.
Well, you know, for me, one of the things that really stands out is, who was it that benefited from 9/11?
There you go.
And, you know, we have talked about a lot of the benefits that have come to, you know, the war machine, so to speak, and the Israelis and some of the other things. But you look at the Saudis, how did they benefit? And you can't see a way that they possibly could have, except maybe oil prices went up for a period of time.
Well, they're
in the early century.
There is one company that I can tell you that did benefit somewhat, and that would be the Bin Laden. Serious, the Bin Laden Construction Company. Now, you'll remember that Osama Bin Laden, who was also known as Tim Osman when he was a CIA asset in the mid-80s, you remember that his family, and actually, I can't remember the relative, his uncle or brother or brother-in-law. I mean, the family's huge, so you just have to know that. One of his relatives was with Bush Sr. right before 9/11, the morning of, the night before, in, I believe, a Washington, D.C. hotel. And he was also involved with the Carlyle Group. And we've talked about the Carlyle Group a lot. And when you get into this and you start to see how connected the Carlyle Group is, well, then you have to understand that this is the Saudi government and the Bush family and the like. So one, that's about the only way I saw any Saudis connected. I do have a PDF in the Freedom of Information Act data that tells not only of the Bin Laden family, but of the Saudi royal family that were inside the United States, whether they were in college or they were here vacationing or they were in Las Vegas doing what you do in Las Vegas. I guess you shop and gamble and just vacation because it's always fun there. But yeah, some of them were there, and they were all literally flown to an area and flown out of the country. In that first 72 hours or so when none of us could fly, the Bin Laden family was gathered up and the Saudi royal family was gathered up by the United States government and flown to safety. Not only were they, but approximately 250 Israelis, some of which were Mossad, some of which were traveling art students, some of which were maybe people that were involved with the Urban Moving Company and other Mossad front companies, and if they were Israelis. And there were about 250 of them. Some of them had been suspected as being spies, were I believe, Tel Aviv, to Israel. So you see, now that's kind of interesting if you think about it. Because really, listen, just put yourself in the president's seat for a second. If you had the Saudi royal family here, and I, you know, I'm just ballparking because I've read the list and it's pages worth. Let's just say you had 100 Saudi royal family and, you know, 60 or so a Bin Laden family. And you had this attack and you had, remember, we had Ehud Barak over there in BBC studios telling us it was Osama Bin Laden who did this attack right there that morning. Within 12 hours, they knew this was Osama Bin Laden. So if you're picking up all these people because you know where they're at because you've got their you know, visas and you know their location and they are royal family. So, of course, we're keeping track of the State Department knows where they're at. If you've ever traveled, especially to countries like that, they know where you're at, too. So we knew where they were at, so we're collecting them all. Would you send them home or would you keep them to say, okay, Mr. Bin Laden, what the hell's going on here? And use them as a pawn in that game or that, you know, let's say, let's just send them home to safety. That just doesn't make any sense. If you were trying to get the details of how did they do this, how did they manage to do this? So I think through the two books, we figured out how they managed to do it. They weren't involved at all. So they sent them home to safety because, you know, Americans turned real ugly because we had an Israeli guy standing there sitting there at BBC studios telling us, hey, the Arabs did this, the Muslims, radical Muslims did this. But we know now that at least 10 of them are still alive. So they couldn't have done it. So that's the shift right there. And you know what? I kept going back to that. Well, how did they do this? How did these guys fly this? Because I was so brainwashed to think that these 19 Arabs did that, that is the first shift I think you have to take. And that's one of the things I kept slapping myself with is, okay, the hijacker's still alive. Come on. That's what pulled me out of my original novel about being a flight attendant and got me into researching what the heck really did go on 9/11, because the flight attendants weren't following protocols and that sort of thing. So that's just kind of where I'm at with the Saudi thing. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense at all that you would send all of those Saudis home to safety when you thought they were somehow their country or their countrymen or something were involved. And remember, they claimed that 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens. And so
well, one of the things I wanted to add is, whereas the second book, The Methodical Deception, has a tendency to expose the Mossad in mm-hmm. all of this, this third book is really going to expose a lot of the CIA
That's
in the
right.
background. And
don't
the fact
tell them. Be quiet, because I don't want them to find me.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you worked for CIA.
Oh, don't tell Fetzer. Yeah, if I did, yeah, I guess I'd be dead by now. I probably would never have gotten the first book out. I just don't, you know, it's really funny because I guess if I really was a CIA agent. Oh, I wish we could play that song again. But YouTube doesn't like it. If I really was a CIA agent at 53, it would just be so much nonsense that I would be pointing out to who I am pointing to. But what I wanted to do when I really got into this was I wanted to just find out what happened to the planes and the passengers and the crew members. And really that's what I did. And I don't care what Judy Woods thinks happened to the buildings, quite frankly, because she doesn't know what happened to the planes and the passengers. And she doesn't like novels and she's out there dissing me. I don't really care. I could give a rip about any one of these people. All I wanted to do is help people wake up to the truth and the reality of what really happened. Now, getting on to the third book, it's blowing my mind. It's a fun. I am absolutely having fun. And quite frankly, if I seem a little bit distracted, it's because I've been in there writing and I'm living. I am just living these characters and what they're doing because I'm pulling all the research that I'd done and wrapping it into this page turner. I hope it's a page turner because it's right. I mean, I'm typing as fast as I can, as fast as I can see it in my mind and hear them talk. And it's really, to me, this one's going to be the best one. I guess, you know, I've never written before. So the first book wasn't all that hot to me.
You know, what's really interesting too in this is that all of the stuff that you're putting into this third book really did happen. And I know you wrap it around fictional characters for the most part, or people that have come forward and given you information that you have made fictional. But the point is, and I think you will probably say something to this effect in your foreword of the book, is that, you know, when you read this and you see and you understand what it is that's going on with these fictional characters, most of what you're reading actually did happen and really is the result of your research. And that's the fun part of being able to do what you do. I mean, if you were doing a nonfiction book and you were just laying it out there, you know, people wouldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
With a fiction book, they come into the story thinking, well, I'm not going to believe it anyway.
Yeah.
And yet it's so compelling and so, you know, expressive of what really happened that day. They end up do believing it. It's kind of like the world's turned upside down.
Yeah, well, that's true. And it's just been really fascinating sharing that wake up with people because, you know, they can obviously find me and email me and ask questions. And I'm very available for that. Someone recently asked me for the terabyte of information. And what I think I'm going to do after this one, I need to get this one out. And once this is done, I'll look into a way that if you're interested to get that terabyte, I also, it's, I don't know, 790 gigabytes or whatever. It's just shy of a terabyte, but you'd need to have a terabyte of like an external hard drive that big. And so if I'm going to sell those, which I could, because it takes a while to upload all that stuff into a terabyte. So I'd have to buy external hard drive and take the time to get it all pushed into there and then mailed out to you. So if it's something, you can email me. If it's something that you'd want to do after the third book is on the market, maybe I'll make that available at, you know, at a certain price. And if you're into that sort of thing, you're welcome to do it. And I'm happy to share it with you. I didn't steal any of it, unbeknownst to Jim Fetzer. That thinks I stole it, but it is all Freedom of Information Act data that a gentleman was pulling out of the United States government National Archives for 4 to 5 years. So it's a lot of information.
Well, and what's really ironic is he didn't even know what he had.
No.
You didn't know what he had.
Well, you know, I at least understood airport codes, but it wasn't really until I had people after the second book came out that came forward to help me read through the data. And it wasn't until I told them what had happened with the real aircraft that they went, oh, aha, okay, well, now we're looking with a different set of eyes. And because of that, this great little team that I've amassed that have come forward to help read through these documents, where since we know what direction to look in, we can see what we were looking at. And before, we were all led to believe that the airplanes flew somewhere else, that they flew into the buildings, that did things that they really didn't do. And one of the anomalies I just want to bring up, I've got a little list of things that we hadn't talked about yet. But one of the anomalies that I want to mention, it's in the second book, is what happened to me when I looked into the file that, well, for one thing, they labeled a file on 9/11 about 6:37 in the morning East Coast time, a couple hours before, hour and a half before Flight 11 ever took off. And they labeled this voice as a terrorist, which they would never have done because we never had that word in aviation in FAA. We only used the word hijacker because there was no such thing as terrorism like this prior to 9/11. But when I found a file, it's a wave file, it's a voice of a person who has some sort of accent that is saying something about, you know, we have some planes, we're going back to the airport sort of thing. When I saw the FAA had put a copyright on that and that it was uploaded in the meta tagging on the file was at 6:37 on 9/11/2001, I went, uh-oh. That means that this file was created an hour and a half before the plane left, and there's no other way you could do that. So I started looking at all the other files for those early upload dates. Now, as what Ricky would say to Lucy, you got some splaining to do to the FAA. And then when I saw that Thomas Keene actually had a problem getting the truth out of the Pentagon and the FAA, I put all of it together, and there was that big piece of the puzzle. I just could not believe what I was reading because, of course, I always trusted the FAA. But just some of the – that's an anomaly, the early upload dates and time stamping that the computer did when these files were saved to the FAA headquarters, because I have documents in the Freedom of Information Act external hard drive, information that I have in this hard drive, that the FAA didn't even receive files from outlying areas like Boston Center or New York Center or D.C. Center until long after 6:37 a.m. or 8 in the morning or noon even, as some of them had come through. So it's mysterious how that happened. So that's an anomaly, and it's in the book. Another anomaly we didn't really talk too much about is the Odigo text messaging service out of Israel, and that people always wondered how come there weren't very many Jewish people in the towers. And they actually got a message and a text message from the company called Odigo Text Messaging to tell them not to go to work inside the World Trade Center towers that morning. Another thing that's really interesting and quite the anomaly is, we talked about this before, Air Force One did not left Florida without a fighter escort. Very, very much an anomaly. And also the Secret Service failed to get the president out of there right away. And it wasn't until after the Pentagon was struck, three aircraft had hit three different buildings, that they actually, he decided he would leave that school. So they didn't do their job that day, which, you know, that's to me a huge anomaly. Another thing that I wanted to mention is that we sometimes forget what happened after 9/11 because we were all so stunned. I put me in that category. I was too. But remember anthrax, and the anthrax that came out in the weeks following, I think it all came out in October, if I remember correctly, and I'm just pulling this out of my memory bank, but I do remember reading that a character that was connected with security and also had been part of the New York City Emergency Management, Jerome Hauer, was also on the board of a company, and he had gone to the White House, and he had Bush and those in the White House on Cipro, which is the antibiotic for anthrax exposure, a week prior to anthrax coming out as a in a mailing to the Tom DeLay got it, and there was a couple other people that you know, maybe we're outspoken, or some people were journalists. I know that got it by accident. I know one hospital worker was killed from the anthrax. So, and then when you look into the whole anthrax thing with that Ivan's character and Steve Hatfield, who was also connected to the CIA, And, you know, they first said it was him, and then they blamed it on Bruce Ivins. But then the Stephen Hatfield, you know, he got his medical degree outside the United States in South America, Ecuador, someplace like that. And then they blamed him, and he sued the government and got a $5 million reward settlement right away. But he ended up sitting on the board of directors for, I believe it was SAIC. Ooh, did I just say that? Remember, he's very connected. So, again, another kind of a crazy anomaly, and we forget about the anthrax because, you know, we're always busy talking about the planes and all that stuff. But when I'm looking at all of this stuff, another thing, just a reminder, and take a note of this because I want you to do some homework on this one. People wonder, and there's a lot of stuff from architects and engineers from 9/11 Truth and that group and some other truthers. And they wonder how could NIST, N-I-S-T, it's the National Institute for Science and Technology, I believe is what it stands for. How could they say that this pancake theory and the buildings fell down like that? We obviously, if you look at videos again, that is not pancaking. That looks like a nuclear explosion. I mean, the stuff is just blown off that building. I mean, the building literally is blowing apart. And I was earlier this morning looking at some pictures and found a picture of that top segment of the South Tower that we were talking about last week, where it looked like it was going to fall onto the street. Remember, I was in a panic thinking about having been in Manhattan down in the around the towers and in the towers. Said, oh, my goodness, how many people are in the street at that hour, 9 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it was just crazy. But remember, and jot yourself a note on this, NIST is under the control of MITRE, M-I-T-R-E, all capital letters, M as in Mickey Mouse, I-T-R-E. Look it up. Just do the Wikipedia on it. Just read that first big paragraph, and you're going to see right at the very end, the very last sentence is going to tell you that they control NIST. They also control all the radar for the military, NORAD, and FAA, and they have since the early 50s. So the fact that we had these aircraft that couldn't see the airplanes on their radar, now there's a reason for that. Because of MITRE's involvement. Remember that Brian Sweeney, he was the passenger that called his mother 3 minutes before impact on United 175, supposedly looking down on top of, he was actually flying, according to the FAA, what they say, the aircraft was kind of over the Hudson and looking down on Newark International, right? Newark Liberty Airport, I think is what it's called, actually. And so he thought he was in Ohio. Well, hello. Okay, well, chances are he wasn't anywhere near that airplane. He was probably in an office somewhere making the phone call. So when I started to see all of this stuff, but here's the one big anomaly it just creeps me out. No matter how many times I go over the phone calls, is that no one on all of the phone calls, and keep in mind, there were, there were something like well over a dozen on flight 93. There were two on the first call. There were two flight attendants. Now, flight attendants know one thing. They know when the plane is descending. And that plane obviously was descending. Now, they also know another thing. They know what Manhattan looks like. And the girl who was on the phone when she was asked by her supervisor, do you know where you are? What do you see out the window? I see planes. She says, I see buildings. I see water. A flight attendant would say, I see Manhattan. I see New York, New York, New York. I mean, you just know it. And when I started to look at this stuff, I thought, well, is this creepy or what? Because remember, we talked about the phone calls on flight 93. Flight 93 came from 42,000 feet down to 19,000 feet. Well, Jeremy Glick was on the phone to his wife, and he never mentioned a descent. And when Todd Beamer, Let's Roll, and the guy whose cell phone kept making calls till 8 p.m. that night. Let's roll on that cell phone, Todd. You know, all of these guys that were supposedly going to rush the cockpit and blah, 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 all that crazy ass story that they did or supposedly did. Not one of them told anyone on the phone that the plane was landing or descending. Now, how can you miss that? How can you go from 42,000 feet down to 5,000 feet or less on the ground and no one say, hey, we're landing, or hey, we're in a huge rapid descent and the airplane feels like it's going to fall apart? They all sat there very calmly as if they were in the room next door. And so where were they? Because we know they weren't on those planes doing what the FAA said they were doing. So one of the things that is really also kind of weird is that the 9/11 Commission report never mentioned that Building 7 fell down. And also another thing that's really weird about the whole thing in retrospect looking at it is that FEMA was given the sole authority to do the investigation on what happened down in Ground Zero.
Well, I think part of the problem with 9/11 is the fact that any of the investigations that were done in kind of a surreptitious manner, and things were hidden. They were done quickly. And I think one of the really evidentiary things in your books is you're trying to get people to move forward and maybe open a new investigation with regards to 9/11. I don't know that that will ever happen. But clearly the investigation that they did was mostly cover up. It was, you know, cover our butts because, you know, we'd, like you said, we got a lot of splaining to do, and they didn't want to do that splaining.
Well, that's very true. And it's funny because of the gentlemen and women that have joined me that have military special operations, the DARPA, air traffic control. I mean, the people that have really come forward to help me uncover what's coming out in the third book are an incredible team. I couldn't have done any of this without them, honest to goodness. So, I mean, I can send people the FOIA information. It just won't make any sense to you unless you've got a background in aviation in a huge way. Because I had 30 years in there, and I could read the airport codes. That's about it. I had no idea of the waypoints and the things that pilots know.
Well, it's really more important than that is because you didn't know the procedures. You didn't know the procedures of air traffic control. You didn't know how they managed their logbooks, what kinds of things were put in the logbooks. And until you got somebody that had, you know, years and years of experience with that, you know, you didn't know, but now you do. And it's the same thing with, you know, these phony 9/11 truthers that think they know everything. You know, if they don't understand how things work in specific fields like airlines and air traffic control and radar and those things, you know, they're just blowing smoke.
Yeah. Well, they have that crazy theory that they throw out there, and then they make up all these lies to make it try to work in their head, and then try to do a YouTube and try to convince someone because they've got some weird agenda. And I can't figure out what it is. I'm not even going to try because it's just too weird for me. But anyway, I have to apologize for laughing because someone said, well, this is such a serious subject. But it is serious. But if you knew what kind of crazy stuff was going on, from trolls attacking, making all these weird accusations that I'm somebody but I'm not, that I'm a chemist, that I'm a this or I'm a that, I'm a CIA agent, it's all just insane, that it is kind of funny. So pardon me if I'm laughing. Some people love my laugh, but everybody's got a complaint. And so then I owe apology to a wonderful lady that took offense to me saying, and I think if you go back, I said, oh, I shouldn't use this word. But we were talking about these trolls and these retired professors that are out there making all these false accusations and crazy claims. I used the word retarded because that it just popped into my head because I'm from that generation where when you were, they call you a douchebag now, but well, we use the word retard, I guess, or retarded. But anyway, she took offense to it. So sorry about that. But I didn't mean to say that word. I mean, it's just so convoluted and insane what these lunatics are doing. I can't even believe it. Well, someone just wrote to me just recently, and they bought both books because they heard this professor dissing me. And same with Pete Santelli, the guy that's in prison now, and they'll never get out. I got contacted from someone who had heard him dissing me and some crazy lunatic claiming I was somebody else. And what the hell difference does it make who I am? I didn't write the book about me. I wrote the book about 9/11 and what I found investigating. So we know who the Zionists are, I guess, now, huh? Pretty easy to tell. Anyway, I just want to talk about some of more of the anomalies before we run out of time and just me gabbing.
We like it when you gab.
Well, I am. I'm gabbing 9/11.
Sometimes we hear your nervous laugh.
Well, I mean, it is kind of crazy. We've got our cat here. We've got Ramjet here doing stuff. And every once in a while.
Ramjet's watching the basketball game.
You'd like to be, I know. Anyway, another thing that people have asked me, and yes, this is kind of an anomaly, but it's not all that uncommon. Because I think nowadays and after this, and maybe even surrounding this time, because I remember thinking it myself, the loads of passengers on the flights were really light. Like Flight 11 was around 50%. Flight 175 was around 30% of the normal load, a full load. Flight 77 only had about 20%, and United 93 only had about 16% of their full capacity. And people think that's really weird. How did that happen? Well, there's a few things that were going on that I've uncovered from some companies that were involved with reservations and were able to tap in to the phone lines and the computer systems. And just because I don't think we've mentioned this for a while, but I've talked about it on some interviews, both United home office in Chicago and American Airlines had been having that morning had phone and internet problems. Someone was tapping into their systems. And now two of the companies we found involved with the traveling art students that we talk about in Methodical Deception are NICE, all capital letters, kind of like MITRE is, and Amdocs. And these are two Israeli companies working out of Fort Worth, Texas, Richardson, Texas, right around the home office of American Airlines. So that's what they did. They were and the Israeli art students that were traveling, some of them were also they were bailed out by either NICE, N-I-C-E, all capital letters, or Amdocs. They were both always one or the other company bailed these guys out. These are Israeli Defense Forces, bomb experts, and some of them were surveillance. These are IT and telephone tapping people. That's who they were. So a coincidence, I know, but that's what we found. Call it what you want. Another thing I haven't really talked about in the anomaly shows that we've done is that in the Pentagon, the Pentagon was under, had just been in the process of being renovated in that west wing or west block of the building. It was being reinforced with steel and Kevlar, I believe, both. And most of it was done. So a lot of people weren't moved in yet, but there were two offices that had moved in, the Office of Naval Intelligence and the Army Auditors. And both of those offices were looking into the misplaced $2.3 trillion from Rabbi Dov Zakheim, who was the comptroller at the United States Pentagon. Yes, we had an Israeli rabbi, dual citizen, as the banker of the United States Pentagon. And he had misplaced $2.3 trillion with a T, dollars. And they were the investigation ongoing at the ONI and the Army Auditors Officers. They were not next to each other, but both of them were wiped out, and approximately 125 military investigators from both offices were killed. Now, think about this for a second. Take yourself to the Pentagon, and you're a hijacker. What Middle Eastern country would it have helped, or what terrorist group would it have helped for you to destroy the investigation into Rabbi Dov Zakheim misplacing $2.3 trillion? Surely not the Saudis. Surely no one in Afghanistan. And surely no Iraqis, because there weren't any Iraqis even on board, or Afghanis. So who? Oh, did I say Rabbi Dov Zakheim? Interesting. So who do you think the hijackers really were? How did they know? And what would it benefit anyone? Who did it benefit? Oh, there we go back to your question. Who benefits? Who benefited from that investigation into the misplaced $2.3 trillion?
As Deep Throat said in All the President's Men, follow the money.
Follow the money. Somebody just posted that in my group earlier today, yeah, too.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and another thing that's interesting, and I've read lots of different things about this.
Oh, but I want you to hold that thought for a minute, okay, because I want to back up just for a bit. You know, you were talking about all the dead bodies in the Pentagon as a result of people who were in the Pentagon that died because of the explosion mm-hmm. that took place. And I remember having a conversation with an Air Force officer who was actually in Alaska at the time. And, you know, I was trying to explain to him that, you know, I had on perfect authority that, you know, an airplane did not hit that building. And he claimed, oh, yes, it was. I saw, you know, video of the fact. And I'm thinking, you did not see video of any airplane hitting any building. But what he was saying was, is I saw all these dead bodies. Mm-hmm. Well, the friend of mine who said that it wasn't an airplane, he himself was out taking care of dead bodies because, you know, as an Army officer, that's what he had done for, you know, for years and years in his special op training and, mm-hmm. and all the things that he had done. And so, you know, people get a little, things a little convoluted. They think, oh, because I saw dead bodies, there had to have been an airplane. And yet,
yeah, there was no
there
airplane.
There was no
part.
Airplane.
Not from a 757 anyway, I should say. Let me clarify this because there were some planted parts, but they were from a different aircraft, not a commercial plane either. So one of the things that was happening also that day that caused a great deal of confusion, and this is an anomaly. There are so many coincidences. Operation Northern Vigilance was a war game going on, and they were there was another one called Vigilant Warrior and Vigilant Guardian. And these were simulated hijackings involving live radar injects. Now, we know there was a company in the FAA headquarters that could do this. They could put things in and take things out, as you read in the books. And this caused a great deal of military and civilian personnel monitoring's confusion of what the heck was going on. Because of these war games, the National Reconnaissance Office, now this is the ones that monitor all of our satellites now. These satellites go around and take pictures of everything, like airplanes on the ground somewhere in a reserve base in western Massachusetts and the like. And they had also a drill going on that day, and they were drilling that a plane had crashed, I believe, into their building. And they'd actually evacuated a bunch of people, sent them home because of this. There was another thing called the Tripod 2 bio-warfare exercise that was going on, scheduled for the following day, September 12th. And that resulted in FEMA being stationed the night before 9/11, in Manhattan. What are the chances? FEMA was there because I just remember I told you that the 9/11 Commission gave FEMA, who is not an investigative authority at all on anything, not buildings collapsing, not bombs going off, not airplane crashes, nothing. FEMA was given sole authority over Ground Zero in New York. Now, that's to me an anomaly. That's to me something that you should pay attention to. So, you know, it's another interesting thing. One of the things I've done, and, you know, I tried to do this without it being too confusing, but you guys can do it too. In the people that were involved with NORAD, if you got your pen and paper ready, be like Lindsay Williams here. General Richard Myers, who was the acting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that day because General Hugh Shelton was busy. And we're going to find out what General Shelton was doing in the third book. So he leaves Richard Myers, General Richard Myers, in charge that day. And in spite being unable to provide any meaningful answers to any questions regarding our air defense failures that day, all of these guys in the military got promoted right away. And some of them left right away. General Richard Eberhardt, look him up, E-B-E-R-H-A-R-T. He was the commander of NORAD on September 11th. He was promoted to be the head of the newly created NORTHCOM. And NORAD's press release contradicted their earlier statements about the high-ranking officials that were involved and why no interceptors had been scrambled on 9/11. And so they started changing all the details.
Well, I think if you want to do some really interesting investigation, and I know you haven't even done this, but we've talked about it on occasion, that if you want to do some interesting investigation, look up all the general officers. And what I mean by that is anybody who's a 1 to a 4 star or an admiral in the Navy, how many of them left the service and retired within 60 days of 9/11? Amazing how many of them did. A lot of them retired within the next week.
Yes. The guiltier they were, the sooner they left. And we talked about the guy, for just going brain dead on his name right now, that worked for Phoenix Air. And Phoenix Air, of course, we know is a rendition flight service that is owned and operated by the Central Intelligence Agency. No, I wasn't a flight attendant with them, Fetzer. But, you know, there's just so many connections. One of the things I was looking up the other day was how many front companies that the CIA operates that actually are airlines. It will blow you away to look into that. But one of the things we mentioned last week, and we just have a little bit of time to touch on, because this is, to me, it's kind of creepy, because I get these emails a lot from people, aren't you scared they're going to kill you? Yeah, well, sort of. But I'm not afraid of dying, but yeah, I know that I've always watched what's going on. I think I'm being as careful as I can be, because I know the monster. I know who did this. I know how it was done. I know lots of things that people don't even know. Like, you can't even fathom what you're going to read in the third book, because I couldn't fathom it until I started to see proof of it and started to see it all uncover and sat down with this team and say, oh my gosh. And even today, if I stop and really think about the magnitude of what we've uncovered and the magnitude of the planning, the methodical planning that went into this, and all of the control by the media. And so when I see things going on now, like the Saudi 28 pages all over, just pay attention, because that's just a smokescreen.
What did I read the other day about, like, you helped me remember this, something, it was a reporter who basically said, you know, all the news is a bunch of baloney.
Oh,
it's
that
all
was that guy from Germany.
Yeah, from Germany.
They all, they all kind of work for the CIA. And, you know, it's funny. There's a guy on CNN. I've forgotten my mind blowing. I'm in my novel. Sorry, I'm just detached. I forget his first name. Bayer, B-A-Y-E-R. And he was a former CIA agent. Let's see if I can think of it. Gary, I think it is. Isn't it Gary?
I think so.
And so they introduce him as a former CIA agent. And he's been involved in some really nasty stuff. I mean, got to understand what the CIA does. I mean, they basically go in and meddle and take governments down. Remember the arms for drugs for arms. And remember Gary Webb, the guy that the movie called Shoot the Messenger, I think it is.
Well, and that's the CIA part we know about.
Mm-hmm.
The CIA part that, you know, stays dark and undercover and does whatever they want.
Yeah.
It's a whole other story.
That's very true. And yeah, I was doing some research on that. And there is an element of some CIA people that have gone in. And I think this is working into another book, not the one I'm working on. But they are a rogue CIA operation. And they're able to operate outside the laws that normally would affect the FBI or the CIA or a government agency. So that's what we've got going on now. That's what ISIS is. But I just want to touch on some of the mysterious deaths, because we talked about this just a little bit last time, and it is kind of creepy. But you'll remember Barry Jennings, large black gentleman. He was some sort of a building. I forgot what he was. He's some sort of New York City building manager type guy. And he was eyewitness to explosions and dead bodies inside Building 7. Remember Building 7 that didn't fall down, but it really did at 520. So he came out of there. I forget the name. I think he was traveling with another guy that was with him. And they came out, and his interviews, you can find these online too, because he did some interviews. And he died of undisclosed causes, but I remember reading about it right away and other things that they thought it was a heart attack. But it was a little while after 9/11. There was another guy who was a World Trade Center janitor, I believe. His name was Kenneth Johanneman, I believe. And he claimed that he saw no airplanes hit the buildings, that the floors inside the towers just started blowing up. He died from gunshot to the head, and it was ruled a suicide. And I think he was one of those right-handed guys with a bullet to the left temple, if I remember correctly on him too. Beverly Eckert, she was a wife of someone. She was what's called an ear witness, where she heard explosions after the building supposedly had been hit. She was talking to her husband. And now, remember Beverly Eckert, she was somebody who talked to Obama right after he got in to office, I believe, if my memory's serving me correctly. And she refused to take hush money. She wanted Obama to do something about this. And she died in that commuter crash outside of Buffalo, New York. in the winter, and they said the plane had iced up. Well, planes don't do that normally. But it just pitched and went right down into somebody's house, I believe. There was another guy who was a dentist, David Graham. He was a dentist, and he claimed that he saw three of the suspected 9/11 hijackers, along with a Pakistani businessman. And I know that people ask for people's ID, and I know I have neighbors and that I can't figure out where they're from. So I'm not sure how he knew they were. The guy was a Pakistani. But in Shreveport, Louisiana, and he went to the FBI with this information shortly after 9/11, and he was mysteriously poisoned by antifreeze. Don't know how they got him to drink that, but there was another guy named Paul Smith. He was the pilot for WABC Channel 7 in New York, and he took the infamous international shot from the chopper, the helicopter. He died in a car accident. Let's see. One of the 9/11 victims' families, you know, they put together a group and they were trying to get something put together. Michael Doran, he was their attorney, and he died in an airplane crash. So we think about people like Paul Wellstone and Korean Flight 007. Christopher Landis, he was a former operations manager for the Safety Service Patrol for the Virginia Department of Transportation. And he was interviewed by the makers of the YouTube movie, The Pentagon, C-O-N. And he gave the makers of the Pentagon movie his photo collection. And inside, it was involved with a response of the Pentagon, he was. And he was suicided as well. John O'Neill, we all know that John O'Neill, he was an Osama bin Laden specialist. He knew everything about Osama bin Laden, probably that he was also Tim Osman, the CIA asset. So he was given a job as security in the tower, and I believe that was his first or second day of work, and he died in the World Trade Center tower. Deborah Palfrey, she ran an escort service. I think you'll remember her because she was on Alex Jones' show, and she told Alex Jones, "I'm not suicidal. I never have been, never will be." She suicided by hanging, which, by the way, since I was trained in emergency medicine and worked a lot in hospitals in emergency medicine, suicide for women is very, very uncommon, hanging. Women like to be a little bit neater. They usually choose drugs, and they're not that hard to find. So I thought that was really interesting because it was a very abnormal way for a woman to kill herself. Let's see. There was a U.S. general who ordered fighter jets to scramble on 9/11. His name was David Whirley, W-H-E-R-L-E-Y, Whirley. And he died in a train crash. Kind of interesting, isn't it? There is also an unnamed ticket agent from Boston Logan, who supposedly checked in Mohamed Atta and Al Omari. Both of those two gentlemen are, in fact, still alive. And that ticket agent was suicided as well, American Airlines. Let's see who else is kind of interesting. But you can see there were some people that, some firefighters. Here's another interesting one. It's a chairman of an Israeli company that handled security at the airports. So he was with Huntley USA. He was an Israeli guy named Ezra Harel, H-A-R-E-L. And he died mysteriously of a heart attack shortly after. And these are like suspiciously connected within, you know, most of them were within the first probably 2 years. So 2003, 2004. And there's lots more than this. And this is kind of an old list I just, you know, grabbed up when I was trying to get ready to do the show. But there's lots more. There was a stepdaughter from Captain Burlingame, Flight 77. And she died in a mysterious death in an apartment fire. And her boyfriend had just recently moved into an apartment. He got out and accidentally locked the door behind it. She was locked in. Now, how hard is it to lock somebody into an apartment? How hard is it to get out? Very mysterious death. Also, I believe his wife died of a mysterious heart attack at a young age in her 50s, early 50s. And there's some speculation that maybe he made a phone call after he was supposed to be dead and that they had to be silenced after that. Yeah, you never know. I don't know that. So I haven't talked to them. They're dead. But for some reason, there was another gal. Let's see if she's on this list. I just remember her because her story was just incredible. Remember Bruce Ivins, the guy that was the patsy for the 9/11 anthrax case? He died of a drug overdose, probably suicided too. But this gal, I forgot her name. The reason I forget her name, it's East Indian or Pakistani. Oh, here it is. She's on this list. Her name was Prasanna Kalahasti. I think they're Pakistani or Indian. Her husband was a passenger on Flight 11. She was a dental student, I believe. I think she was still in school, a sweet girl, and she suicided by hanging. And it's very unusual for her. I think they were Hindi religion. Very, very unusual. I mean, I read the story a long time ago about all of these people that mysteriously suicided in ways that you would be just like totally against your religion. And in this, well, that was her case. Young girl, had lots of things going for her. And again, now do we know? Because we do know that Todd Beamer's cell phone kept calling somebody. I don't know who. But until 8 o'clock that night. Now, how did that cell phone make it through, along with that one hijacker's paper passport and nothing else, no titanium engine parts or nothing else from Flight 93?
It was hooked to the hijacker's passport.
Maybe.
And that's how it survived.
Maybe. So, you know, it's kind of, sorry, I'm laughing, my nervous laugh. I'm not really nervous. I just say it's just, it get to a point when you see this, it's like you just can't believe in coincidences anymore. So I guess when you get in as deep as me and you blow yourself out of the water and you write these books and you start waking people up and then talk about it, it's mind-blowing. And, you know, it's kind of goofy. It's,
well, you maybe laugh occasionally because you can't spend the rest of your life crying.
Well, I can't cry. I mean, it's not going to do any good to cry. But it is going to do good to wake people up to who really did this. And it wasn't the Saudis. And so, but you have to ask yourself, okay, well, if it was the Saudis, why have we never attacked Saudi Arabia? We've just built a couple large airfields there, Air Force bases. And another thing to mention, the Bin Laden construction family, they were hired to build Air Force bases and fast food joints. And there were $20 million and $30 million contracts all over Iraq and Afghanistan. So they did somewhat benefit, but not near as much as Israel benefited, because immediately going into Iraq, pipelines for oil and gas went right into Israel. Boom. Number one thing. Number one priority. So if you stop and take a look at what really went on and who was really involved in what countries we've gone in and blown up, and we're now taking Syria down, these are following the step-by-step process that the Project for a New American Century, PNAC, and those who wrote the paper calling for the new Pearl Harbor, which was 9/11. And it was all planned out. And so, you know, all wars are bankers' wars, so who runs the banks? So when Saudi Arabia comes out and says, if you, the United States of America, come at us and blame us for 9/11, we're going to pull the plug on you financially. And they have the power to do it. And they'll take every bank down in this country, won't they?
Well,
you're
that's
shaking
why
your
threat,
head.
That's why the threat is. It's not necessarily to the United States per se. It's to the perpetrators of 9/11.
Exactly. And that's, there you go. That was the message. And I read that this morning when I got up. I was reading the Drudge Report and I was laughing to myself like, okay, well, this ought to be interesting because the same people run the media.
Well, now, didn't you tell me that Obama's in Saudi Arabia right now?
I think he is. I remember reading that he was on his way there because it was one of his, you know, he's on the cruise tour, his last
farewell
leg,
tour,
his last leg of ripping through the money, spending as much as they possibly can. So I think he is. I saw the picture and I think that he is actually in Saudi Arabia. And I think that's why it's all coming out now. So,
yeah, well, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is. And it'll be really interesting to see what happens here over this next week or two. Because remember, you're not going to hear anything from the mainstream media that they don't want you to think. So you're being directed and guided. And the psychology of blaming radical Islam and then flooding countries with the open gates that we have, it's happening here, it's happening in Europe, is just spreading hate, because you can't have a civil war without people hating each other. And you've seen ethnic cleansing over the years. Just look back in history, because it is repeating itself. And it looks like we're out of time. You want to say goodbye?
Again,
gosh.
You know, usually we drag Frank out, but, you know, he's still in the bar, so he's not coming out today. He's still upset about his son passing away, and I don't blame him for that. But it's always fun to do shows with you. I'm looking forward to now parachuting off the mountain, getting back to civilization where internet service really is good and not just kind of hit and miss. But thank you for listening. We're always excited to hear your And until next week, we'll see you.
Yeah, thanks. Aloha. Take care from Switzerland.